It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, well, let's start things out on a good note.
Yes.
There was a legal win this week for the Friends of Gaswork Park.
Yes, this is the group that sued last spring in an effort to stop One Wheeler Productions in the city of Seattle from essentially ramming a concert series at Gaswork's Park down the throat of Wallingford residents, not only without any kind of public process or involvement or even notification, but all, and in a way that was particularly inappropriate for that park, but with allocation of $150,000 in city council money for what is basically a private concern. And their concern wasn't just a NIMBY one. It was a more broad one also of appropriate uses of parks, because we're seeing this again and again. We talked about this on the program a lot about the way the Parks Department has stirred the ire of a lot of different neighborhood groups. Well, the Friends of Gaswork's Park won. They went to court. What they did is they sued, claiming that the city needed to do an environmental review on the park, particularly because Gaswork's is atop a toxic waste fill. Its soil is really nasty, and you're going to have people coming in all summer and you know, kicking it up. So they won. It was a somewhat limited ruling in that it was not what they hoped, that the city would be required to do SEPA environmental reviews on all such special events. It was ruled as being particularly appropriate because of the toxic soil at Gaswork's. But nonetheless, it was a significant victory. The city can choose to raise other issues in that court. It can choose to appeal the ruling, or it can choose to comply and initiate the SEPA review process. If it does initiate the review process, which it has never done before for a special event, and Park Superintendent Kane Bounds has been, you know, pledging and swearing that he would never do such a thing, for reasons that totally escape me, because it, you know, avoids them getting into trouble like this, or with the Eagles for the fireworks at Union Bay a few weeks ago. If they do comply, then they probably can finish it, assuming there's no major problems with it, in time to hold the 27,000 concerts at Gaswork's Park, which the city has already pledged to do. So it doesn't necessarily stop the concerts, which is the goal of Friends of Gaswork's. That's still to be seen. But it sure looks like the city is going to appeal it. And part of what that's based on is what the Parks Department was telling local reporters, which basically was that this was the first step in the legal process, which is, you know, factually not accurate. The city can make it the first step if they choose to appeal, but this ruling, if it's not further appealed, has the force of law. The PI had that component to its story, but it was basically factually correct. The Seattle Times, however, had a horrible story that was not just biased, but flatly factually wrong on the court's ruling. I was in the courthouse courtroom. There were no other media spectators present. In fact, there were only seven or eight other people even watching the hearing outside the participants. And what happened was that the Times sent an intern who normally writes for the UW Daily, this being summer when a lot of regular reporters are off on vacation, and so this sort of thing happens. And the Parks Department and their spokeswoman, Dewey Potter, who, when I did a long article on Parks for Seattle Weekly a few months ago, told me some flat-out whoppers, so I think she's just sort of truth-challenged, just told her some stuff that wasn't true, and she didn't have the experience or the sense to try and collaborate it or to have her BS detectors in place. So it's not just a question of bias by major media sometimes. Sometimes it's just incompetence or inexperience. But that's how stories like that can be so wrong in this case is the largest paper in the state and ostensibly the paper of record for these types of stories. They were just wrong.
All right. Well, moving on to a state level, looks like there's a couple initiatives that are moving towards our ballot.
Yeah, there's a number of them, actually, at least four really bad ones that look like they will be on the ballot in November. It's going to be a busy season for trying to stop these initiatives. Tim Eymann's anti-gay initiative, of course, did not get on the ballot, and we all celebrated about that. Although, parenthetically, I would add that a number of right-wing Christian groups are trying to organize to still combat the gay civil rights bill, whether it be through the initiative process or back at the legislature again. That issue is not dead. Don't celebrate yet, even though Iman's initiative won't be on in November. But Iman will have another initiative, I-917, which is his attempt to repeal a number of legislative taxes on car tabs that take it above the $30 level, but whose money primarily goes to transportation. So it would take a huge chunk of money out of transportation programs for the state. He filed his signatures this week and has way more enough to get it on the ballot. Also, I-920, which is the anti-estate tax initiative that's, you know, we're going to hear a lot about from Frank Breathen in the New Seattle Times, speaking of them. And there's a couple more that are now gathering signatures that look almost certain to be on the ballot in November. One is an anti-immigrant initiative, similar to California's Prop 209. And the other is something the Farm Bureau has been pushing that would be similar to Oregon's measure last year, requiring compensation if environmental or other regulations detract from property rights. It's very similar to Referendum 48 a few years ago. All four of those are very likely to be on the ballot in November. So, you know, organizing should start now because if these initiative backers get the jump on ballot organizing, and I know for a fact the Farm Bureau has raised enough money and plans to mail petitions to every single Seattle Times subscriber in the next few weeks. We need to start getting the word out about why these are a bad idea. So educate yourself and get busy.
Moving along, the folks at the Snohomish County PUD are smiling and breathing easier today.
Yeah, wrote about this in the Weekly and I Need the State a few weeks ago. The Snohomish PUD and several other local agencies, the Tacoma Power, City Light, Seattle City Light, the Port of Seattle, are all seeking compensation from Enron for money that Enron ripped off during the 2000-2001 energy crisis that Enron manipulated, has now been found to be the case in a court of law. Those cases have not yet been resolved, although Tacoma Power settled for pennies on the dollar this past week for its claim. It still has a $175 million lawsuit against Enron that's pending. But Enron, in turn, was trying to pocket $120 million, $140 million with interest from the Snohomish PUD because the PUD abrogated a contract that it was forced to sign for exorbitant rates with Enron at the height of the crisis, and it later abrogated that contract, saying that Enron had misrepresented itself and committed fraud in the signing of the contract. Well, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the same folks that stood by and did nothing during the crisis itself and which have been fairly sympathetic to Enron throughout this, actually ruled this week that Snohomish PUD was correct, that because the Enron had misrepresented itself, that the contract could legally be voided, and that's what Snohomish PUD did. So they will not have to pay what would have amounted to $500 for every single ratepayer in Snohomish County. It was a huge victory, and a lot of credit goes to Jay Inslee and particularly Maria Cantwell, who have been working on this issue for years, so good for them.
You know, related to that, there was a tiny little thing in today's paper under the business briefing, which I thought should have been on the front page, which is basically the prosecutors want Enron execs to pay $183 million in damages for the case. And I just was shocked to see that that's, you know, like way off in the business section where you'd never see it.
So. Well, that's why you have to read the business section. And that's why publications like the Wall Street Journal are so valuable, because things that are of a concern to investors, you find out a lot more about corporate crime that way than you do about reading the front section, because it very rarely goes to the front section. We've talked about that in this program, and particularly when Maria was on the program. She followed that very closely. That's a very common feature of our media, unfortunately.
Yes, I understand that, but nevertheless,
it's kind of shocking. No, you're right.
Let's move on to national. The Supreme Court couple big decisions this week, actually multiple decisions this week.
Yeah, the one that got the most attention, of course, was the striking down by a 5-3 ruling of the military tribunals for Guantanamo prisoners. And there's a particularly interesting aspect to this ruling, was that the Supreme Court ruled them to be illegal both under U.S. law and under the Geneva Conventions, specifically Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions that applies to the conflict. The Supreme Court ruled that it applies to the conflict with Al-Qaeda, which has been the Al-Qaeda, which has been the whole undermines the entire rationale of the Bush administration, saying that this is a different type of war. It's not a war with nation states. In other words, the Geneva Convention does not apply because the rules of war do not apply. These are not prisoners of war. These are enemy combatants and so forth. All of that was undercut by the Supreme Court ruling. It's not just the military tribunals, which are now legally questionable, and not it's not just that all of these other cases, the enemy combatants, the holding people without trial or charges or access to due process, the refusal to allow the International Red Cross in to monitor treatment of prisoners of war, all of the torture, all of that is applicable if the Geneva Conventions are applicable. The other thing that happens is that it then kicks in the War Crimes Act and raises, at least theoretically, although it'll certainly never happen with a Bush Justice Department, that top Bush administration officials can and should be prosecuted for war crimes because they, in fact, have violated, particularly in the arena of torture, the Geneva Conventions. And you can follow that chain all the way up through Rumsfeld and the White House. So that was interesting. The other thing that was interesting and very scary about the Guantanamo ruling was how easily it could have gone the other way. It sounds like a fairly comfortable margin at 5-3, but it wasn't. It was actually 5-4. John Roberts recused himself because he had heard this ruling and actually written the opinion for it, I believe, at the appeals court level when he was on the appeals court, and the Supreme Court decision reversed the appeals court ruling. The appeals court had ruled for the Bush administration, so it would have ordinarily been 5-4. The guy who wrote the opinion for the Supreme Court is Justice Stevens, who is in his 80s and in ill health and is widely expected to retire soon, possibly before the end of the Bush administration term. If Bush is allowed to appoint a Supreme Court justice that replaces Justice Stevens, if this case had come up a year from now, for example, and Stevens were gone, it would have gone the other way. And, that's how close we are to having this sort of stuff be legal under the Supreme Court. And if Stevens is replaced by Bush or other Republican appointee that is willing to, trample on the Constitution in this way, we're going to have a generation of rulings like that. It's very, very frightening how close we are to that. And with Roberts and Alito, we're already there in a lot of cases, as we've seen by recent rulings this week, this year rather. Since Alito came on the court. A couple of other rulings this week that were not so good. One of them was that the Supreme Court basically upheld the gerrymandering in Texas that was done at the behest of Tom DeLay with districts that made no geographical sense, but which were computer designed to cement a Republican advantage in Congress. The Supreme Court said that was okay. And then and that's in a state with the Civil Rights Act in effect also. And remember also that Civil Rights Act is due to expire and is being held up by Southern congressmen who object to it. And then the Supreme Court also ruled by a 6-3 margin that a Vermont campaign finance reform law was unconstitutional, not just on the basis of campaign donations being free speech. They expanded on that ruling a little bit because not only did they strike down the provision of the Vermont law that limited the amount that candidates could spend on campaigns, saying that limiting the amount you can spend on a campaign is an abrogation of free speech, they also throughout the limits that the state of Vermont set on the total the level of campaign contributions that donors could make, saying those limits were quote unquote too low. Now, this in a small, rural, relatively unpopulated state. I think the whole population of Vermont is like 750,000 at most. Limits for statewide offices were between $200 and $400, which is, you know, about what it used to be for Seattle, the city of 500,000, until the limits were raised a couple of years ago. So it really wasn't that out of line. But the Supreme Court decided that that was an abrogation of the Constitution. And so the question that is now raised is, well, what kind of a limit isn't too low? Or are they going to take the next step and say that the limits on campaign contributions are themselves unconstitutional? Sort of a frightening possibility.
All right, moving along. The executive branch was also busy beavers this week.
Yeah, in the You Know They're Watching You department, a FOIA request to the Department of Defense revealed the information this week of still more infiltration and surveillance of anti-recruiting groups, anti-military recruiting groups, at four different universities around the country. And I think you can assume that's going on around the country, and including here in Seattle, for people who are working against military recruiters. Just assume that your emails and phone calls are being monitored, because they almost certainly are. Plus, they were also targeting Don't Ask, Don't Tell groups, GLBT rights advocacy groups. Now, what that has to do with anti-terrorism, which is the rubric this is all falling under, is anybody's guess. But there you go in modern times. We also had an expansion a little bit on the bank's records scandal that was reported by the New York Times and we mentioned last week. Apparently, SWIFT, the banking clearinghouse cooperative in Belgium that handles and tracks international financial transactions and whose records the Treasury Department was monitoring, apparently Belgian authorities, the government of Belgium, had no idea this is going on and has launched an investigation to determine whether it was illegal. They believed that it was. And it's just staggering in an operation of this type that at least as far as they're publicly claiming, the government of Belgium had no idea this was happening. That incidentally has almost not gotten reported at all here in the United States. Another place you had to go overseas to find out more about, the Belfast Telegraph had a very interesting analysis this week of the indictment of the seven young dreadlocked African Americans in Miami who were the quote unquote homegrown terrorists. The indictment has a little actual evidence of any plots whatsoever. And as we've heard, I think more widely in U.S. media, there were no explosives found. It was basically just folks talking, and they were talking to an FBI operative who was posing as Al-Qaeda representative. But a lot of news reports have characterize this group of young men as a Muslim plot because of their willingness to talk with Al-Qaeda. Well, it turns out that they're both Muslim and Christian. They're a number of them belong to some strange sect called the Seas of David that meets for Bible study, prayer, and martial arts. It's not at all what it appears to be, and we need to remind ourselves that there's a history ever since 9/11 of the Bush administration making spectacular claims about the arrest of quote-unquote terrorists here in this country that usually turn out to be very fringe people with, nothing more than a vague desire of, being jihadist wannabes. That is almost certainly what's going on here as well, and you would think the media would learn the lesson by now. And then finally, today, there's a real nasty Medicaid rule that is going into effect, promulgated by the Bush administration, that has the likelihood of throwing millions of people off of Medicaid assistance around the country. And that is that it now requires proof of citizenship in order to get Medicaid benefits. Well, the problem, and ostensibly this is to keep illegal immigrants from getting Medicaid, and there's virtually no proof that that's a problem. But what it does is it cuts out the homeless, it cuts out many many elderly African Americans who were born in the South at a time when black women were not allowed in hospitals. It cuts out an awful lot of people who simply don't have that kind of documentation. It cuts off people like, you know, stroke victims who can't talk, who can't tell people where to find the records. All sorts of problems are being raised by this, and the Bush administration is basically just throwing them out.
All right, moving along. The Congress and Senate this week were also busy.
Oh, yeah. The Senate rejected the flag desecration amendment. Thank goodness, but it was only by one vote. And Cantwell and Murray both voted no, to their credit. The Senate approved an amendment to the 2007 Defense Appropriations Bill that would reinstate the whistleblower protection that was thrown out by the Supreme Court a few weeks ago. The counterspin mentioned this. The Commerce Committee moved on to the Senate for a major communications bill, really the first one since the 1996 Communications Act, which was the biggest piece of corporate welfare in American history. This one had several important components. Net neutrality was rejected. That was an amendment that was co-sponsored by Cantwell. Another piece that Cantwell co-sponsored, to her credit, is included, and that would expand low-power FM to large cities. So if it survives the rest of Congress with this bill, one positive out of what's generally a bad telecommunications bill is that Seattle could be getting low-power FM stations fairly soon. We had several other things on Capitol Hill this week. Estate tax is being pushed once again. There's a proposal back in the Senate, and the way they're doing this is attaching amendments that put Democrats who voted no in particularly dicey positions. And they've got one amendment which is going to be politically very difficult for Murray, Cantwell, and Ron Wyden of Idaho, all of whom voted no on repealing the estate tax, and that is a provision that would exempt 60% of timber sales from the highest level of corporate tax. Of course, Weyerhaeuser and other timber companies being a major political player here. Murray and Cantwell have both said they are now undecided on this bill. So they need to hear from constituents. If you want the estate tax to be retained, call Cantwell, call Murray, urge them to vote no on this because it's going to be resolved in the next week or two.
Ron Wyden's from Oregon.
Ron Wyden is from Oregon. That's correct. Also very vulnerable to timber industry pressure. The House passed a bill this week that will end the 25-year ban on offshore oil drilling. Bill was only made available to legislators hours before the vote was taken place, showing that that practice did not end with Tom DeLay's departure. And we had some revelations this week in the Abramoff scandal. Roger Stilwell, a desk officer for the Marianas Islands at the U.S. Department of the Interior, pleaded guilty to misdemeanor false certification in his testimony in the case. This is the first case where we've found somebody who's being prosecuted around Abramoff's connections with the Northern Marianas Islands, which revolved around Seattle because Abramoff did all of that while he was working for Seattle's Preston Gates Ellis. They were the legal firm that managed to cement the sweatshop situation in the Northern Marianas Islands in the late 90s. And then Grover Norquist and Seattle's own Rabbi Daniel Laban and his Torah tradition, him and the Americans for Tax Reform of Grover Norquist, both nonprofits, both were revealed to being used to launder money that Abramoff was funneling to different political campaigns and preferred clients of his, which could put both of their nonprofits in severe IRS problems. And lastly, a report from BushGreenWatch.org, and I'll just read this in its entirety. It's only a paragraph, and it's important. GOP congressional leaders may bring to a vote within weeks a proposal that could literally wipe out any federal program that protects public health, the environment, civil rights, poverty programs, auto safety, education, affordable housing, Head Start, workplace safety, or any other activity targeted by anti-regulatory forces. With strong support from the Bush White House, the proposal would create a sunset committee, an elected body with the power to recommend if a program lives or dies. It would then send its recommendations through Congress on a fast-track basis with limited debate and no amendments. Scary stuff, so watch for that.
Jumping to international, Palestine-Israel this week.
Yeah, a nasty situation there and an appalling performance by U.S. media, which Israel-Palestine is nothing new. The shelling of Gaza, a humanitarian crisis looming there, a kidnapping of a third of the Palestinian Authority's parliament, including 8 cabinet ministers, 87 Hamas members of parliament, have basically been they've been arrested. They've been kidnapped, essentially, by Israel. And all of this under one soldier who's being held hostage, which very much demonstrates both for the Israeli government, as we talked with Olmert's comments last week, how much Israeli lives are valued over Palestinian lives. They're punishing 1.4 million residents of the Gaza Strip over one Israeli life. And of course, collective punishment of that type is an international war crime under the Geneva Conventions, but you won't hear that in U.S. media.
There was also a power plant that was hit this week.
Yeah, well, I want to get to that. Okay. Some of the things that are going on in Gaza and the reason why it is shaping us up as such a humanitarian crisis, they hit a power plant so that about half of Gaza is now without power, and the other half gets its power directly from Israel, so that could be cut off at any time. They have also sealed the only pipeline into Gaza. So not only is there no power for water wells, but they, by Monday, are going to run out of fuel for the generators that are now running the water wells, meaning that people are by Monday not going to have fresh water. And this is in the middle of the summer in the Middle East. Remember, this is on top of bans and importation on medicines and a lot of foods that have been going on after Israel sealed the borders to Gaza a number of months ago. So a nasty, nasty situation there. This and the Israeli military also massed on the borders of Gaza and may invade really at any moment. And none of this will be going on without the approval of the Bush administration. You can be sure of that. A lot of it's being done with U.S. money. It's something that is certainly not going to enhance the reputation of the United States and the Muslim world. That's for sure.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, I want to talk also about the presidential election going on tomorrow. In Mexico. And Greg Palast had a very, very good column. I think it was yesterday, maybe Thursday, but you can certainly find it on the net, talking about the ways in which the Bush administration is seeking to intervene in a very close presidential race in Mexico between the conservative incumbent PAN and a left of center political party, with the candidate being the former mayor of Mexico City. The election is considered to be a toss up, and very similar to what they do in terms of trying to throw elections in the United States. The Republicans are trying to do it in Mexico too. Look for that.
Unfortunately, only 2 minutes left. Iraq.
A lot going on in Iraq. There's a quote-unquote national reconciliation plan that the Prime Minister Maliki has put into play, basically a Washington ploy, unfortunately, and the major provision, one for amnesty for insurgent fighters, was withdrawn the day before the plan became public. So read into that what you will. There was an offer by 11 or Sunni insurgent groups to halt attacks if the U.S. led military occupying Iraq would agree to a 2-year timetable for withdrawing all foreign troops. Unfortunately, the U.S., of course, not only rejected that out of hand, but you didn't really hear about it here. The U.S. Army has launched yet another probe, the sixth one that is now going on over charges that civilians have been murdered by U.S. troops. This one charging that 5 U.S. soldiers were involved in the killing of 4 Iraqi relatives, including a woman who had been raped. Military officials said yesterday that the soldiers burned rather the body of the women as well, and this is in a town south of Baghdad. And the rate of of death of U.S. soldiers was way up again. 24 U.S. soldiers killed last week, so I think we figured out by now that Zarqawi's death didn't really bring it into the insurgency the way it was sold. And I don't have time to get into this, so I'm going to have to blog it on the ETH Estate blog. But there's a really nasty video going around, and it's created quite a stir and a lot of defense by sort of moronic conservatives of U.S. Marines singing a really racially offensive song about killing an Iraqi family. And this, and I have the lyrics to it. And this is, you know, exactly why in the battle for hearts and minds of Iraqis, the U.S. has lost spectacularly, is that type of attitude.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State, and briefly tell people where they can find Eat This State.
Yeah, Eat This State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a local publication of local, national, global news and events. There's also a blog on our website. You can find the paper free of charge at bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, places like that. And you can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org. Have any questions, tips, comments, want to volunteer, phone number, my voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.